Waging Good by Robert Reed. Chapter 1. The spaceport resembled a giant jade snowflake set on burnished glass. Not a year old, it already absorbed much of the moon's traffic. Unarmored and exposed, the port didn't have a single combat laser or any fighting ships at the ready. Fat new shuttles came and left without fear, a casual, careless prosperity thriving below. Who would have guessed? In the cold gray wash of Earthshine, who could have known? When Sitta was growing up, people claimed that Nearside would remain empty for 1,000 years. There was too much residual radiation, wise voices said. The terrain was too young and unstable. Besides, what right-thinking person would live with Earth overhead? Who could look at that world and not think of the long war and the billions killed? Yet people were forgetting. That's what the snowflake meant. For a moment, Sitta's hands trembled and she ground her teeth. Then she caught herself, remembering that she was here because she too had forgotten the past, or at least forgiven it. That's when she sighed and smiled in a tired, forgiving way, and blanking her monitor, she sat back in her seat, showing any prying eyes that she was a woman at peace. The shuttle fired its engines, its touchdown gentle, almost imperceptible. Passengers stood, testing the gravity. Most were bureaucrats, attached to the Earth's provisional government, pudgy Martians, with a few Mercurians and Farsiders thrown into the political stew. They seemed happy, almost giddy, to be free of the Earth. The shuttle's crew were belters, spidery-limbed and weak. Yet despite the moon's pull, they insisted on standing at the main hatch, smiling and shaking hands, wishing everyone a good day and good travels to come. The pilot, 3 meters of brittle bone and waxy skin, looked directly at Sitta, telling her, "It's been a pleasure serving you, my dear, an absolute joy." 8 years ago, banished from Farside, Sitta carried her most essential belongings inside an assortment of hyperfiber chests, sealed and locked. All were stolen when she reached the Earth, and that's where she learned how little is genuinely essential. Today she carried a single leather bag, trim and simple, unlockable, unobtrusive. Following the herd of bureaucrats, she entered a long, curling walkway, robot sentries waiting, politely but firmly asking everyone to submit to a scan. Sitta felt ready. Waiting her turn, she made the occasional noise about having been gone too long. "Too long," she said twice, her voice entirely convincing. The Earth had left its marks. Once pretty in a frail, pampered way, Sitta had built heavier bones and new muscle, fats and fluid added in just the last few months. Her face showed the abuse of weather, save around her thin mouth. Toxins and a certain odd fungus had left her skin blotchy, scarred. Prettiness had evolved into a handsome strength. She needed that strength, watching the robots turn toward her, a dozen sensitive instruments reaching inside her possessions and her body, no place to hide. But these were only routine precautions. More thorough examinations were endured in Athens and the orbiting station, and she was perfectly safe. There was nothing dangerous, nothing anyone could yet find. Which was when the nearest robot hesitated, pointing one gray barrel at her swollen belly. What was wrong? Fear began, and remembering the sage advice of a smuggler, Sitta hid her fear by pretending impatience, asking her accuser, "What's wrong? Are you broken?" No response. "I'm in perfect health," she declared. "I cleared quarantine in 3 days." "Thank you," the robot withdrew the device. "Please continue." Adrenaline and the weak gravity made the next stride into a leap. The walk tube took a soft turn, then climbed toward the main terminal. Another barrier had been passed. Sitta coached herself. A simple ride to Farside, another cursory scan at the border, then freedom for the rest of her days. The impulse was to run to the public rail bugs, but the spectacle of that was sure to draw all sorts of unwanted attention. Forcing her legs to walk, she kept thinking, I just want it done. Now. Now. Two signs greeted her entry to the terminal. Welcome to the new Nearside Interplanetary Transit Facility and Peace Park. And beyond those tall, viscous letters was a second, far less formal sign. Sita's name was written in flowing, liquid light script, accompanied by shouts and applause, a tiny but enthusiastic crowd of well-wishers charging her, making her want to flee. Surprise! They called out. Are you surprised? They asked. Nervous faces crowded close, examining her scars and general weathering, everyone fighting the urge to blatantly stare. Then she set down her bag, taking a breath and turning, showing her profile, making everyone gawk and giggle aloud. Hands reached for her belly. Pony, flippant as always, exclaimed, Oh, and we thought you weren't having any fun down there. Insensitive and graceless, and every other face tightened, ready for her anger. But Sita politely smiled, whispering, Who could have guessed? Not once, even in her worst daydream, had she imagined that anyone would come to meet her. How could they even know she was here? With a voice that sounded just a little forced, Sita said, Hello? How are all of you? She grasped the nearest hand and pressed it against herself. It was Varner's hand, large and masculine and soft. When had she last felt a hand both free of callus and intact?
No wonder you're home early,
Varner observed, his tone effortlessly sarcastic.
What are you, 8 months along?
More than six, Sita replied, by reflex. Ice, once her very best friend, came forward and demanded a hug. Still tall, still lovely, and still overdressed for the occasion, she put her thin, long arms around Sita and burst into tears. Wiping her face with the sleeve of her black and gold gown, she stepped back and sputtered, We're sorry, darling, for everything. Please. Varner said,
Ice, in warning.
Accept our apologies, please. I came home, didn't I? Asked Sita. The question was interpreted as forgiveness. Every face grinned, yet this was far from the same old gang. Where were Lean and Katchen and Unnel? The twins had made it, still indistinguishable from each other, and Vetchel, silent as always. But there, people hanging in the background, wearing the suffering patience of strangers. Spouses or spies? Sita had to imagine this was some elaborate scheme meant to keep tabs on her. Or perhaps some species of slow, subtle torture was being unleashed as a prelude to things even worse. Everybody was talking. Nobody could listen. Suddenly Varner, always their reasonable, self-appointed boss, shook people and declared,
We can chat on the rail.
Turning to Sita, he winked while asking,
May I carry this lady's satchel?
For an instant, in vivid detail, she remembered the last time she had seen him. Varner took her hesitation as a refusal.
Well, you're twice my strength anyway.
Probably true.
Out of our way, people. A mother needs room. Make way for us.
They used slidewalks, giant potted jungles passing on both sides. Staring at the luxurious foliage, unfruited and spendthrift, Sita wondered how many people could be fed with crops grown inside those pots, and how these treasures might be transported to the earth. More thoughts needed to be choked to death. Turning to Ice, she examined the rich fabrics of her gown and the painted, always perfect breasts. With a voice intense and casual in equal measures, she asked, How did you know I'd be here? Ice grinned and bent closer. We had a tip.
Sitta was traveling under her own name, but she'd left the plowshares in mid-assignment. Besides, plowshares were supposed to enjoy a certain anonymity, what with the negative feelings toward them.
What kind of tip, darling?
I told one of your administrators about us, about the prank, about how sorry we felt. Her long hands meshed, making a single fist. She knew your name. The famous Sitta, she called you. One of our best. Nodding, Sitta made no comment.
Then just yesterday, without warning, we learned that you'd been given a medical discharge, that you were coming home.
Tears filled red-rimmed eyes.
I was scared for you, Sitta. We all were.
I wasn't, said Varner. A little cancer, a little virus. You're too smart to get yourself into real trouble.
Sitta made no comment.
We took the risk, made a day of it, Isonice continued. She waited for Sitta's eyes to find hers, then asked,
Would you like to come to my house? We've planned a little celebration, if you're up to it.
She had no choice but to say,
All right.
The others closed in on her again, touching the belly. Begging for attention, Sitta found herself looking upward, hungry for privacy. Through the glass ceiling, the gibbous gray face of the earth showed featureless and chill. And after a long moment's anguish, she heard herself saying,
The last time I spoke to you...
Forget it, Varner advised, as if it was his place to forgive. Isonice assured her,
That was eons ago.
It felt like it was minutes ago, if that. Then Pony poked her in the side, saying, We know you. You've never held a grudge for long. Pony. Varner had a gift for delivering warnings with a person's own name. Sitta made no sound, again glancing at the earth. Again, Varner touched her with his soft, heavy hand, meaning to reassure her in some fashion. Suddenly, his hand jumped back. Quite a little kicker, isn't he?
She, Sitta corrected, eyes dropping.
6 months along?
Almost seven.
She held her leather bag in both hands. Why couldn't she just scream at them and run away? Because it would draw attention, and worse, because someone might ask why she had come here. Sitta had no family left on the moon, no property, nothing but some electronic money in a very portable bank account.
I guess I don't understand. Why would anyone even bother?
Because, Isonice proclaimed, taking her best friend by the shoulders. We knew you deserved a hero's welcome. Our hero, people muttered, those words practiced but poised. Our own little hero. And now she was a hero. The ironies made her want to laugh, just for an instant. She had come to murder them, and she was heroic? Welcome home, they shouted in unison. Sitta allowed herself another tired smile, letting them misunderstand the thought behind it. Then she glanced at the earth, longing in her gaze, that world's infinite miseries preferable to this world's petty, thoughtless abuses. Chapter 2. The war ended when Sitta was 4 years old, but for her and her friends, it hadn't existed except as a theory, as a topic that fascinated adults, and as a pair of low-grade warnings when the Earth fired its final shots. But they were never endangered. For all intents and purposes, the war was won decades before. The Earth in no position to succeed, its enemies able to weather every blow, then take warm pleasure in their final campaigns. Victory was a good thing. The 4-year-old girl understood good and evil, winning and losing, and why winners deserved their laurels and losers earned their punishments. She also understood, in some wordless way, that Farside was a special place meant for the best people. Its border was protected by fortifications and energy barriers. Several thousand kilometers of dead rock lay between its blessed people and the enemy. Bombs and lasers could obliterate Nearside, melting it and throwing up new mountains. But on Farside, for more than a century, the citizens suffered nothing worse than quakes and some accidental deaths. Friendly bombs and crashing warships doing more harm than the entire Earth could manage. Other worlds told different stories. They were always fighting for survival, every life endangered. No place was safe but the back of the moon. And that's why Farsiders were the great winners. Sitta's family made its fortune in genetic weapons, adaptive plagues and communicable cancers, plus a range of parasites. Following a Farside custom, her parents waited until retirement to have their child. It was the same for Ice and Ice, for Varner, for everyone, it seemed. Sitta was shocked to learn as a youngster that near youngsters could make babies. She had assumed that humans were like the salmon swimming up from the central sea, a lifetime of preparation followed by a minute of desperate spawning, then death. That's how it was for Sitta's parents. Both of them expired even before she reached puberty. An aunt inherited her, an ancient, stern, and incompetent creature, and when their relationship collapsed, Sitta lived with her friends' families, all pleasant and all indifferent toward her. Growing up, she learned about the Great War. Tutors spoke about its beginnings, and they lectured for hours about military tactics and the many famous battles. Yet the war was relentlessly unreal, a giant and elaborate theory presented for her entertainment. She liked the battles for the visual records they left behind, colorful and modestly exciting, and she observed the dead with clinical detachment. Sitta was undeniably bright. Her genes had been tweaked to ensure quick, effortless intelligence. Yet in some fundamental way, she had gaps, flaws. Watching the destruction of Nearside and Hellas and dozens of other tragedies, she couldn't truly envision the suffering involved. The dead were so many abstractions. And what's more, they were dead because they deserved their fates, unworthy of living here, unworthy of lovely Farside. In the beginning, the Earth had 10 billion citizens. It was a wonderland with skyhooks and enormous solar farms, every sort of industry and the finest scientists. The Earth should have won. Sitta wrote the same paper for several tutors, pointing out those moments when any decisive, coordinated assault would have crushed the colonies. Yet when chances came, the Earth lost its nerve. Too squeamish to obliterate the rebels, too willing to show a partial mercy, it let the colonies breathe and grow strong again, ensuring its own demise. For that failure, Sitta had shown nothing but scorn. And her tutors, to the machine, agreed with her, awarding good grades to each effort, the last of them adding, "You have a gift with political science. Perhaps you'll enter government service, then work your way into a high office." Such a ridiculous suggestion. Sitta didn't need careers, what with her inherited wealth and all these natural talents. But if she wanted to work, regardless of reasons, the girl was certain to begin near the top of any organizational heap, inhabiting some position of deserved authority. She was an important child of important Farsiders. How could she deserve anything less? Chapter 3. The railbug was ornate and familiar, an old-fashioned contraption with a passing resemblance to a fat, glass-skinned caterpillar. But Sitta needed a moment to recall where she had seen it. Free of the port, streaking across the smooth glass plain, she was sitting on one of the stiff seats, stroking the dark wood trim. There was a time when wood was a precious substance on Farside, organics scarce, even for the wealthiest few. Remembering smaller hands on the trim, she looked at Varner and asked, "Did we play here?"
"A few times," he replied, grinning.
The bug had belonged to his family, too old to use and not fancy enough to refurbish. She remembered darkness and the scent of old flowers.
You brought me here.
For sex, as I remember it. Varner laughed and glanced at the others, seemingly asking them to laugh with him. How old were we?
Too young, she recalled.
The experience had been clumsy, and except for the fear of being caught, she'd had little fun. Why did anyone bother with sex? She would ask herself that for weeks. Even when she was old enough, screwing Varner and most of her other male friends, part of Sitta remained that doubtful child. The fun of it, merely fun. Just another little pleasure to be squeezed into long days and nights of busy idleness. The railbug was for old time's sake. That's what she assumed, but before she could ask, Ice and Ice began serving refreshments.
Who wants? Who needs?
There was alcohol and more exotic fare. Sitta chose wine, sipping as she halfway listened to jumbled conversations. People told childhood stories, pleasant memories dislodging more of the same. Nobody mentioned the Earth or the war. If Sitta didn't know better, she would assume that nothing had changed in these last years, that these careless lives had been held in stasis. Which might be true, in a sense. But then, as Ice and Ice strode past and the hem of her gown lifted, she noticed the gold bracelet worn on the woman's left ankle. Sitta remembered that bracelet. It had belonged to the girl's mother, and to her grandmother before. In a soft half-laugh, she asked, "Are you married, girl?" Their hostess paused for an instant, then straightened and smiled, her expression almost embarrassed.
"I should have told you. Sorry, darling."
A pause.
"Almost 3 years married, yes."
The buzz of other conversations diminished. Sitta looked at the strangers, wondering which one of them was the husband.
"He's a Mercurian," said her one-time friend, "named Bossen."
The original Ice and Ice adored men in the plural. The Ice and Ice she remembered gave herself sophisticated personality tests, then boasted of her inability to enjoy monogamy. Married? To 100 men, perhaps. Sitta cleared her throat, then asked,
"What sort of wonder is he?"
"Wait and see," Ice and Ice advised. She adjusted the straps of her gown, pulling them one way, then back where they began. "Wait and see." The strangers were staring at Sitta, at her face.
"Who are they?" she whispered.
And finally, they were introduced, more apologies made for tardiness. Pony claimed the job, prefacing herself by saying, "We're all Farsiders here." Was that important? "They've heard about you, darling. They've wanted to meet you, and for a long, long while." Shaking damp hands, Sitta consciously forgot every name. Were they friends to the old gang? Yet they didn't seem to fit that role. She had to resurrect that ridiculous theory about spies and a plot. There was an agenda here, something she could feel in the air. But why bring a dozen government agents? Unless the plan was to be obvious, in which case they were succeeding. A social pause. Turning her head, Sitta noticed a long ceramic rib or fin standing on the irradiated plane. For an instant, when the earth shine had the proper angle, she could make out the bulk of something buried within the glass, locked securely in place. A magma whale. At the height of the war, when this basin was a red-hot sea stirred by 1,000 megaton warheads, Farsiders built a flotilla of robotic whales. Swimming in the molten rock, covering as much as a kilometer every day, they strained out metals and precious rare elements. The munition factories on Farside paid dearly for every gram of ore, and the Earth, in ignorance or blind anger, kept up its useless bombardment, dredging the ocean, bringing up more treasures from below.
The rib vanished over the horizon. Then, with a quiet, respectful voice, Ice and Ice asked, "Are you tired?" She was sitting beside Sitta. Her gown's perfumes made the air close, uncomfortable. "We haven't worn you out, have we?" Sitta shook her head, honest when she admitted, "I feel fine." It had been an easy pregnancy. Then placing a hand on her belly, she lied. "I'm glad you came to meet me." The tall woman hesitated, her expression impossible to read. There was a sternness in the voice when she said, "It was Varner's idea." "Was it?" A sigh, a change of topics. "I like this place. I don't know why." She meant the plane. Bleak and pure, the smoothest portions of the glass shone like black mirrors. "There is a beauty," Sitta allowed. Ice and Ice said, "Which makes it all so sad." "Why? What's sad?" "They're going to tunnel and dome all of this."
"Next year," said an eavesdropping twin.
"Tunnels here?" Sitta was dubious. "You can shield a spaceport and a rail line, but people can't live out here, can they?"
"Martians know how."
Ice and Ice glanced at the others, inviting them to do what?
"They've got a special way to clean the glass."
"Leaching," said Varner. "Chemical magic combined with microsheens. They developed the process when they rebuilt their own cities."
"People will live here?" Sitta wrestled with the concept. "I hadn't heard. I didn't know."
"That's why they built the port in the first place," Varner continued. "All of this will be settled. Cities, farms, parks, and industries."
"Huge cities," muttered Ice and Ice.
"This ground was worthless," growled one of the strangers. 5 years ago, it was less than worthless."
Varner laughed without humor.
"The Martians thought otherwise."
Everyone looked dour, self-involved. They shook their heads and whispered about the price of land and what they would do if they could try again. Sitta thought it unseemly and greedy and pointless. Pony said,
"You know, it's the Martians who own and run the spaceport."
Sitta did her best to ignore them, gazing back along the rail, the earth dropping for the horizon and no mountains to be seen. They were at the center of the young sea, her home world smooth and simple. Far out on the glass, in a school of a dozen or more, were magma whales. As their sea cooled, they must have congregated there, their own heat helping to keep the rock liquid for a little while longer. Sitta felt a strange, vague pity, then fear. Shutting her eyes, she tried to purge her mind of everything fearful and tentative, making herself strong enough, trying to become as pure as the most perfect glass. Chapter 4. Sitta couldn't recall when the prank had seemed fun or funny, though it must have been both at some moment. And she couldn't remember whose idea it was. Perhaps Varner's, except the criminality was more like the twins or Pony. It was meant to be something new, a distraction that involved all of them, and it meant planning and practice and a measure of genuine courage. Sitta volunteered to tackle the largest target. Their goal was to quickly and irrevocably destroy an obscure species of beetle. How many people could boast that they'd pushed a species into oblivion? Rather few, they assumed. The crime would lend them a kind of notoriety, distinctive yet benign. Or so they told themselves, feeling clever and alive. The Ark system was built early in the war. It protected biostocks brought from the Earth in finer days. Some 20 million species were in cold storage and DNA libraries. A tiny portion of the stocks had been used as raw material for genetic weapons. Sitta's parents built their lab beside the main Ark, and she had visited both the lab and Ark as a girl. Little had changed since, including the security systems. She entered without fuss, destroying tissue samples, every whole beetle, and even the partial sequencing maps. Her friends did the same work at the other facilities. It was a tiny black bug from the vanished Amazon, and except for ancient videos and a cursory description of its habits and canopy home, nothing remained of the organism, which was exactly as planned. Sitta would have escaped undetected, but for the miserable luck of a human guard who got lost, making a series of wrong turns. He came upon her moments after she had sent the beetle into nothingness. Caught sooner, her crime would have been simple burglary and vandalism. As it was, she was charged under an old law meant to protect wartime resources. The mandatory penalty was death. Gray-haired prosecutors with calm, gray voices told her, "Your generation needs to behave." They said, "You're going to serve as an example, Sitta." Shaking ancient heads, they declared, "You're a spoiled and wealthy infant, contemptible and vulgar, and we have no pity for you. We feel nothing but scorn." Sitta demanded to see her friends. She wanted them crammed into her hyperfiber cell to have them see how she was living. Instead, she got Isonice and Varner inside a spacious conference room, a phalanx of lawyers behind them. Her best friend wept. Her first lover said, "Listen, just listen. Stop screaming now and hear us out." He told her that behind the scenes, behind the legal facades, semi-official negotiations were underway. Of course, the Far Side government knew she'd had accomplices, and a lot of officials were afraid that the scandal would spread. Friends with pull were being contacted. That's what he assured her. Money was flowing from account to account. What Sitta needed to do was to plead guilty, to absorb all blame, because the judge was ready to fine for clemency using some semi-legal technicality. Of course, there had to be a staggering penalty. "Which we will pay," Varner promised, his voice earnest and strong. "We won't let you spend a single digit of your own money." What were her choices? She had to nod, glaring at the lawyer while saying, "Agreed. Goodbye."
"Poor Sitta,"
Isonice had moaned, hugging her friend but weeping less, relieved that she wouldn't be turned in to the authorities, that she was perfectly safe. Stepping back, the girl straightened her gown with a practiced flourish, adding, "And we'll see you soon, very soon, darling." But the judge wasn't compliant. After accepting bribes and hearing a few inelegant threats, he slammed together the hammers of justice and announced, "You're guilty. But since the beetle is missing and since the prosecution cannot prove its true worth, I cannot in good conscience fine for the death penalty." Sitta stood alone with eyes shut. Then she had heard the word clemency and opened her eyes, except nobody but her had spoken. The judge delivered a hard, withering stare. Sitta would hear that voice for years, syllable by syllable. "I sentence you to 3 years of involuntary servitude." Again, he struck the hammers together. "Those 3 years will be served as a member of the Plowsharers. You'll be stationed on Earth, young lady, at a post of my approval, and I just hope you learn something worthwhile from this experience." The Plowsharers? Those were the very stupid people who volunteered to work and die on the Earth. And this had to be a mistake. And how could she have misunderstood so many words at one time? Her friends looked as if they were in shock. All wept and bowed their heads, and she glared at them, waiting for even one of them to step forward and share the blame. But they didn't. Would never. When they looked at Sitta, they saw someone who was about to die. The attrition rate among the Plowsharers was appalling. Had Varner and the others tricked her into confessing,
knowing her fate all along? Probably not, no. They were genuinely surprised. She thought it then and thought nothing for the next 8 years. But if they had come forward en masse, if another 8 families had embraced this ugly business, there might have been a reevaluation. An orphan's crime would have been diluted, if only they'd acted with a dose of courage. The shits. The earth was hell. A weak Farsider would die in an afternoon, slayed by some nameless disease or embittered Terran. Yet not one good friend raised a hand, asking to be heard. Not even when Sitta screamed at them. Not even when she slipped away from her guard, springing over the railing and grabbing Varner, trying to shake him into honesty, cursing and kicking, fighting to shame the idiot into the only possible good deed. More guards grabbed the criminal, doing their own cursing and kicking before finally binding her arms and legs. The judge wore an ear-to-ear grin. "Wage good," he called out in the end. "Wage plenty of good, Sitta." It was a plowshare's motto, waging good. And Sitta would remember that moment with a gallows clarity, her body being pulled away from Varner as Varner's face grew cold and certain, one of his hands reaching, pressing at her chest as if helping the guards restrain her. And his tired, thick voice said, "You'll be back." There wasn't a shred of confidence in those words. Then, "You'll do fine." And finally, with a whisper, in despair, "This is for the best, darling. For the best."